It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, up to 5% of older Americans are affected by depression, and that percentage nearly triples for those who require home health care. A new study indicates the rate of depression among older Pittsburghers is dropping. Kevin Sullivan is one of the lead authors on that report. He's a psychiatric epidemiologist at the University of Pittsburgh's Graduate School of Public Health. Dr. Sullivan, welcome to the Confluence.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Was there something that you happened to notice, maybe anecdotally, that caused you to wonder, are fewer seniors depressed these days?
Well, I think the question arose from our investigation of a number of different trends in aging that tend to point positively in terms of what healthy aging looks like nowadays, and just stood to reason to investigate not only physical health, but mental health as well.
So you're investigating something positive?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think a lot of trends for aging in terms of, you know, disease and illness and aging are positive, and we wanted to see whether there was kind of corresponding trends in depression symptoms specifically. So we're not looking at actual diagnosis of major depressive disorder. We're looking at endorsement, essentially, of depression symptoms.
Mm-hmm. How common of a problem is depression among older Americans?
Well, I mean, it's as in other age groups, it's relatively common. It's, you know, the most common, you know, mood disorders, depression symptoms. Again, we're not looking at diagnosis, we're just looking at endorsement of symptoms, but it is relatively common. But compared to younger age groups, depression is kind of, I wouldn't say forgotten, but definitely underdiagnosed in the older adult population.
Has the definition changed? What exactly does it mean to be elderly these days? What ages? Has that changed?
Well, so that's kind of related, actually, to our findings. I mean, it's still generally accepted over age 65, we consider the older adult. I think what some of the trends are suggesting is that, well, people are actually living longer, much healthier than they used to. So maybe it is, you know, we're pushing that age limit a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Is it a normal part of that aging process, like other maladies, as we get older? Is depression normal?
I would not call it normal, mm-hmm. just like I wouldn't call, you know, any disease or illness normal. Do they tend to occur more often as people age? Yes. Should we consider that a normal part of aging? No. I wouldn't want to normalize those kind of symptoms. It's that's not what healthy aging is about.
Do life changes that happen as we age that maybe cause uneasiness, maybe stress, do they often lead to depression?
I don't know that necessarily often, but, you know, you do generally expect with advanced age health to decline. You know, older adults are faced with the possibility of losing some of their independence. I mean, you see trends like that, you know, it might stand to reason that you see some mental health symptoms co-occurring with those changes. Like, for example, depression symptoms are very common in older adults who have other medical concerns. You often see those things co-occur together.
Give us an idea of what some of these symptoms might be.
Oh, you know, there's loss of energy, you know, general depressed mood, you know, things like that where they're not feeling as, you know, just straight up questions like, do you feel happy today or did you feel happy during the past week? Those are the sorts of symptoms that we're essentially screening for.
Mm-hmm. And do they vary much depending on the individual, depending on maybe the conditions, the changes that led to those feelings?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think you see a good mix of people endorsing a number of different symptoms. It's kind of hard to predict, well, is this older adult going to endorse that symptom versus this symptom or comparing right. across them. But, you know, you see a general mix of what symptoms are actually endorsed, whether it's depressed mood or it's loss of energy, feelings of hopelessness, things like that.
Was a person's medical history considered with the questions that you wanted to ask, that you wanted to know about?
Yes. So we did our best to model as many different factors as possible to see what could be explaining this trend, and that their medical condition was included in that, as was their cognitive function, their cognitive capacity.
Well, was the cognitive capacity part of the origination of this this study?
Yeah, so the initial intent behind the studies that we're looking at in the Mon Valley was to model cognitive impairment and dementia and things like that with age. When we saw positive trends happening in that, it's actually been found in our study and others that older adults are actually living longer, free from cognitive impairment, and their onset of dementia is getting delayed. that was kind of the motivation to look at, well, okay, what other trends are happening, birth cohort trends, and looking at depression, for example.
Could the onset of some symptoms, could it be a matter of adjusting to changes and the emotions returning to a normal balance? So maybe feeling a bit of depression, but then as you get used to maybe new circumstances, shall we say?
Yeah, I mean, that certainly could be related. You know, what we're looking at long-term, you know, temporal trends here. It's very possible that how older adults experience and report depression has changed over as through successive generations. I'd certainly think that could be possible. It's kind of hard to disentangle what exactly has changed. But I think older adults are always adapting to changes in their health and their living situations that, you know, might be explain some of these endorsements of symptoms, for example.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking with psychiatry researcher Kevin Sullivan from the Pitt Graduate School of Public Health about the new study that found that rates of depression are decreasing among older Pittsburgh area residents. So for your study, give us an idea. How many people did you follow and for how long?
So we looked at over 3,000 individuals in the Mon Valley for about an average of 7 years each. And these are, you know, combinations of studies that went back to being conducted in the 80s and are still ongoing today, following them annually for seeing what their depression symptom reporting was at their visits, at their study visits.
So what was the primary question going into this study? What did you want to know?
Well, so the idea behind a birth cohort analysis is we're comparing older adults who were born in different birth decades, and we wanted to see if there was a difference between how someone born, for example, 1905, what their depression symptom reporting was at age 70 versus someone born, for example, in 1935. And a lot of these birth cohort trends are suggesting that, well, that older adult, that 80-year-old born in 1905, they're actually very different from an 80-year-old born in 1925. And if we wait, you know, a couple more decades, an 80-year-old born in 1965 is probably also going to look very different. So we're looking at a number of different factors. Depression just happens to be one to, you know, disentangle what these cohort effects actually mean.
So the decade, the difference in decades, is it a matter of better health care? What were other factors that you say, well, other than, you know, maybe a 10-year age gap, a decade gap,
right,
of when they were born?
Well, I mean, that's the golden question, right? That's essentially what we're trying to do by looking at birth cohort effects. You know, the year of someone's birth in isolation is a meaningless variable, right? It should have no impact on what their disease prognosis is in late life. But contained within that year, especially when we're talking about older adults, we're talking about a whole lifetime of different exposures and experience that differed between those birth cohorts. So our job when looking at these effects is to really disentangle what was different. And in the case that many of these trends are positive, really, we want to know what went right for that birth cohort versus this birth cohort. And by identifying those factors that did go right, we can continue to improve. And maybe if we see populations where trends like this aren't as robust, they aren't happening or they aren't happening as fast, we can learn from the populations where it was happening and say, you know, what can we do better in this population?
So how did you determine whether they were experiencing symptoms of depression?
So everyone in the study took the exact same screener. It's called the Center for Epidemiologic Studies Depression Scale. It's a simple 20-item scale where they are just endorsing or not 20 symptoms of depression and saying yes or no, did I experience that symptom over the past week?
3,000 people.
Yes.
What's your main takeaway?
I think our main takeaway is that we've seen a positive trend in depression symptom reporting in these older adults. Now, the study is still, you know, our results, as far as we know, were the first in the Mon Valley to report these sorts of results. So it's really important for this to be replicated in other populations and other studies to see if they're seeing a similar trend. Our other cohort effects do tend to line up with what other studies have seen in terms of improving health generally in the older adult population, something that's called compression of morbidity.
What do you mean by that?
So the idea behind compression and morbidity is that older adults now, they're simply living longer into older age, healthier. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a matter of increasing the lifespan, it's increasing the health span, which, you know, as my perspective on public health epidemiology, that's more important.
Was it really surprising that younger, older people had fewer depression symptoms than somebody much older? Does that suggest that physical ailments are the more likely root cause for depression? So as the body gets older, we can't do as much, and that might cause some symptoms of depression.
Well, certainly as you see people who aren't as healthy, which might be occurring up to a point as they age, you might expect to see more kind of psychiatric symptoms accompanying that disease. So you would expect that to a certain extent. What you often see in our study and others is that when older adults reach very old age, or the status of being the oldest old, you often see some of the endorsement of those depression symptoms drop off.
What about other factors? Were they considered? I mean, was there fear of loneliness, maybe even fear of Alzheimer's?
So those are really interesting questions. We didn't look at those questions specifically in this study. Certainly, I think loneliness is something that would be interesting to look at in terms of a cohort design. And as pertaining to Alzheimer's, we have published other works suggesting that, that a delay in the onset of dementia and Alzheimer's disease as well. But, could fears of disease in general be playing into some of these symptoms? Sure.
Last question. In a sentence or two, what do you still want to know about depression among older Americans, older Pittsburghers?
Yeah, well, not only depression, but just in general, looking at trends in aging. And I'd circle back to the point I made earlier. If we're seeing positive trends in aging, it's of huge importance to identify what the actual factors were that explained those trends. So we're seeing positive trends in depression. We're seeing positive trends in other diseases. What factors over time explain those trends, and what can we do to be even better?
That's what you want to do. Is it going to happen?
I hope so.
And we will have links to the study on our website, WESA.FM. Kevin Sullivan is a psychiatric epidemiologist at the University of Pittsburgh Graduate School of Public Health, lead author of a study that found that depression rates among Pittsburgh's older residents are declining. Thanks so much for coming in today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You are listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Mold has been living in a low-income senior housing community in Penn Hills for about a year. Residents say work to address the issue has stalled. Then a pair of one-act operas composed by Mr. Rogers are hitting the stage this week as part of the Pittsburgh Festival Opera. And mental health advocacy organizations have largely opposed any changes to a state law that would make it easier for people to be involuntarily committed. It's left some frustrated about how to help their loved ones. Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
Before it was a hit on Broadway, Jesus Christ Superstar was a concept album about the final days of Jesus' life. With music and lyrics by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice, respectively, it was a commercial and critical success, selling over 7 million copies, and the 1973 film adaptation became the 8th highest-grossing film that year. But before all of that happened, 13,000 lucky people got to experience the album performed in a live concert at the Pittsburgh Civic Arena on this day in 1971. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
Jesus!
Climate change, it's happening. So what is the Trump administration doing about it? A little. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Reed Frazier. In 2015, the Obama administration created the so-called Clean Power Plan, a sweeping rule to deal with climate-altering carbon emissions from the electric power sector. But the Trump administration rolled back that regulation and, in its place, recently unveiled its own plan, the Affordable Clean Energy, or ACE, rule. For our podcast, Trump on Earth, I spoke about this new rule with Jody Freeman, a law professor at Harvard and former counsel on environmental rules in the Obama administration. She said the Clean Power Plan would have cut carbon emissions from the power sector by about 20% by the year 2030.
What the Trump plan would do is reduce emissions from the electric power sector by less than 1%.
Can you describe the sort of main difference in the sort of legal strategy used in the Clean Power Plan versus this new ACE rule?
The two plans are really using the same law. They're both using the Clean Air Act as the authority that the EPA has to put these standards in place, they just have very different approaches to how they would use the Clean Air Act. The Obama team looked at the entire grid and said, using all the tools available on this interconnected machine, how can we reduce greenhouse gas emissions? How can we do that by improving the use of efficiency? So we want the power plants to get more efficient, but we also expect to substitute in more solar power, more wind power, that is more renewables. And we want to also substitute in more natural gas for coal because it's cleaner than coal. What the Trump administration does is quite different. Their approach, they're quite narrow. You might think of it as a very skinny or a kind of very meek approach, is to say, we're only going to look at what the units can do themselves. We're not going to treat them as what they are in reality, which is an interconnected system.
So walk me through what happens next with this ACE rule. What's the next legal procedure that we should be looking for?
It is possible, if this were to go all the way to the Supreme Court, we don't know whether it will, but if the court were to take it, it certainly is possible that they could accept the Trump administration's very cramped, very narrow view of their power and say, the only way to read this law is the way they do. And if the court says that, it could create an obstacle for future administrations. But it's also possible the Supreme Court would do something different. There's a good chance that this won't reach the Supreme Court. Here we are in 2019. It looks pretty tough on this calendar to imagine even the DC Circuit deciding this challenge before the 2020 presidential election. If that's true, you may not get a decision until you have a new president or a second Trump administration. And you know, what this all points to is the fact that we are working here with a statute, the Clean Air Act, which is a very powerful law, drafted to give the agency flexibility, but it is a law that dates to 1970. What everybody prefers is that the one player that's missing in action get in the game, and that is the U.S. Congress. What you're seeing is a pendulum shifting back and forth from administration to administration, and that's the kind of way this is playing out because Congress has not drafted a law to address climate change.
Jody Freeman is a professor at Harvard Law School. There's more of our conversation about the Affordable Clean Energy Rule at TrumpOnEarth.org. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Reed Frazier.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's been at least a year since mold was found in a low-income senior housing community in Penn Hills. 90.5 WESA's Margaret J. Krause reports that residents say work to address the problem has sputtered, despite promises by the owners.
Every night, 70-year-old Jeannie Delancey goes to sleep beneath a dinner plate-sized patch of mold that surrounds the vent on her bedroom wall. The mold showed up last summer, and she worries about breathing it in. Mold can aggravate asthma and lead to infections, especially in more sensitive immune systems. Delancey says she always has a headache and a stuffy nose.
I have loved living here, except the last year and a half, 2 years have been just a nightmare. Because we never know from one day to the next, are they going to come in and shut the whole place down? What are they going to do? Then they don't ever tell us anything.
Beechtree Commons is federally subsidized, but owned by National Church Residences. The Columbus, Ohio-based nonprofit operates 340 housing communities nationwide. Company officials say while there have been signs of mold in the last few years, condensation in the walls last summer added to the problem. However, most units were within, quote, acceptable limits. Getting rid of mold is a complicated task, says Public Relations Director Todd Hutchins. The work could last through spring of 2020.
We are trying to do the best we can to operate this building up to code and exceed expectations by doing all the work that we can and get it done as fast as we can.
Penn Hills building inspectors have visited Beechtree Commons numerous times over the last couple years. They found problems such as uncollected garbage and broken elevators. In January, Inspector Christine Sepsi noted mold in her files for the first time.
So then I did contact management. They did explain that they were aware of it. They were treating it at that point. And they're still treating it as of today, as far as I know.
In fact, a half dozen residents had already been relocated in November, so mold could be removed. 87-year-old Thelma Regan was one of them. First, she was moved to a hotel. then to Beechtree Commons 2, next door. Now Regan lives in a temporary unit near her old home.
It's all torn apart. I don't know when they're going to fix it. They supposedly have a plan to fix it, but I may not live to see it.
Regan's situation makes others worry they'll be relocated too, says Frank LaMica, president of the Tenants Association. He's called and written to everyone he can think of, the company, local, state, and federal officials. In June, he got a letter of his own, a lease violation notice that warned of potential eviction.
You are giving false and exaggerated information to other tenants and contractors regarding the building. How am I exaggerating anything?
The letter said LaMica's efforts were, quote, interfering with management and the peaceful enjoyment of others. Dan Vitek is a staff attorney with the Community Justice Project. An account of the letter gave him pause.
Management should be very cautious when they issue these notices so that they're making sure the residents are not put in fear and are not limited in their rights when, in fact, what they're doing is not a lease violation.
Hutchins of National Church Residences says lease violations are left to the discretion of local managers, but in general,
we would never support a property manager evicting residents who are complaining.
Moving forward, company officials say they'll provide weekly project updates and install new HVAC units for tenants. State Representative Anthony DeLuca says the problem isn't so bad the building has been shut down, and National Church Residences has been receptive to removing the mold.
So you can't ask for anything more from an organization to take care of a problem.
DeLuca says many other operators of senior housing are less responsive to tenants. Margaret J. Krause, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Once upon a time, not so very long ago, lived a king and queen in such a place as you've never seen, not so long ago.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Rosemary Welsh. Pittsburgh Festival Opera is going to be presenting two operas that were written by Fred Rogers. That's right, Mr. Rogers, Windstorm in a Bubble and Spoon Mountain. And directing them is Tomei Cousins, and he's here with me today. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's quite an honor to be here.
Now, I have to ask you about your connection to Fred Rogers. You knew him.
Yes, I was performing in a play that was being performed at the original City Theater Company when it was in Oakland. And another cast member, Maggie Stewart, was a regular on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. She was Mayor Maggie of Westwood. And she was also in the cast. So Fred actually came to see her in the performance, and I just happened to be in the cast as well. And I had a character that was, this is a testament to Fred, is that one of the characters I played was this snapping drag queen. And I used some pretty adult language, and he saw past that and called me like 2 days later and said, oh, and you can imagine, I'm using this really foul language in front of Mr. Lyra. I mean, really, it was quite offensive. But he came backstage and said, oh, lovely, lovely, lovely. And I thought, what an honor to meet him. About 2 days later, he called me back and said, would you like to be on the show? And he created a new character for me called Ragdoll Tommy. Now, my name is Tomei, but they went with Tommy because it would be easier for the children to pronounce. And I was the doll, if you have to use your imagination here, I was the doll of the puppet Prince Tuesday. And so I appeared as a little small doll that the puppet could hold, and then another human adult had to be there to make believe I would come to life. Then I would come to life in a bigger form, and then Prince Tuesday and I would kind of bounce around and get in all kinds of trouble, and then I would resort back to being a puppet. And so that went on for 9 years.
Well, that opens up the good conversation here about these two operas. You know, something that might surprise a lot of people is that Fred Rogers, well, we know that Fred Rogers wrote a lot of music. Operas we didn't know, but you just even opened a door to a much wider perspective that he had. I think a lot of people had an assumption about how he viewed the world and what he thought children could handle. But he actually blew those doors open.
Yeah, quite successfully. His experience as a child, I think he was bringing that into it. He wanted to have a wide range of friends when he was younger, and he didn't have that, ironically. He created puppets in his attic, so that they were his friends. So when people see the characters on the TV show or in these operas, they're puppets in these operas. They are fully fleshed out human beings to him. They were not just little play toys. You know, they had personalities to them, and he would also broaden his scope to include music, art, anything that he saw past what we normally see as barriers, he would see past that and go into the human condition of a person. And I think that's his one of the gifts that he had.
So the operas were performed on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood?
Yes, there were 13 of them in total.
Wow.
13. And I'm not sure where these fall. I definitely know that the last one, Windstorm in Bubbleland, was the final opera that was performed on television. They roughly about 25 to 30 minutes long when they were presented on television. And yeah, there were 13 of them.
That's wonderful, Commodore. Look, look, Wicked Knife and Fork is crying.
So Mr. Rogers didn't make the assumption that children couldn't handle opera. His idea was put it out there and see how children respond.
Yes, and he also found a very clever way, as he always did, of introducing what an opera is to a child and introducing singing and music, combining and separating what a musical is and what an opera is. And the play, I consider them plays because even just reading them, he does that quite clearly and what they could handle. And he still gets in his lessons of friendship and support and love and forgiveness. And all of these are included in these operas. And I think children took to them right away.
Well, music is just another way of communicating. And I think that's why Fred Rogers used music so much. It really was you could get to children on a different level with music.
Absolutely. Some of the songs in the operas are so endearingly touching. And we also included some of his other lesser-known songs to beef up them, to give them a little bit more weight. But yeah, there's some lyrics in there that are pretty amazing for children to have accepted.
So we're speaking with Tomei Cousins, who is directing these two operas, Mr. Rogers' operas, that are going to be performed this month by the Pittsburgh Festival Opera. Have you directed operas before?
Indirectly, yes. With the Pittsburgh Festival Opera, two seasons ago, they brought me in to direct a musical version, the musical Sweeney Todd for the opera company. So I've worked with this particular opera company before and opera singers, but not directed a proper opera myself. But I've performed in many operas, so I'm very familiar with the world that they function in and how they have to learn and how they have to communicate and collaborate.
Now, the opera singers that are doing this, I understand there's a lot of younger performers.
Yes. Pittsburgh Festival Opera has a wonderful summer program that they bring in young performers. Adriana Cleveland is a Pittsburgh local. She's a wonderful Afro-American woman. She's quite wonderful. She plays a character, Teresa, who sells bubbles. And she has a very lovely little ditty, Bubbles for Sale. And it's quite fun.
So, Tomei, one of the questions that I think people would have when they're looking at, Mr. Rogers' operas, these are for kids. But really, the question is, who are these for?
That's interesting you bring that up. There's a new book about Fred Rogers out. I think it's called The Friendly Neighbor, The Good Neighbor by Maxwell King. And he came to Pittsburgh and was at the Heinz Historical Society, and they had an open session. So he was going to speak on the book and talk to people. And I went to see what was going on here. I knew I was going to be directing the operas, and I saw this huge crowd. I think they expected maybe like 100 people. It was mobbed. It was packed. And I said, here's the audience. They're mature people, but I think it's that what I learned is that they are not here to learn something new. They're here to be reminded of what Fred had left with them. And I think that's when it struck me. That's our audience. That's the audience. We already have these values that we learned as children from him, if you were familiar with the show, as well as growing up. And now we have children, and they have, you know, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. And I think everyone wants those values to be reminded and remain. And I think that's what the operas are going to hit on, those points.
And if you want to bring children, I mean, is this something that a very small child could handle sitting through an opera? How long a time period are we talking about?
The first one, Spoon Mountain, is about 25 minutes, and the second one is about 30 minutes. But there's a film in between, a small little five-minute film at intermission that will be shown of people that give their comments on Fred and what they thought and what he meant to them. So the total evening, I'm going to say roughly about an hour, 45 minutes.
So this is something that you could share with your children?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's lots of action. There's lots of color. There's bubbles. There's animals. Like I said, there's puppets. It's quite animated.
Tomei Cousins, thank you so much for coming in and talking about this. Now, this is going to be held July 13th, 14th, and July 20th and 25th, Falk Auditorium at Winchester Thurston School, Pittsburgh Festival Opera, basically celebrating something that maybe a lot of people never got to see or haven't seen in a very long time. Two operas by Fred Rogers.
Yes, excellent.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
I'm Rosemary Welsh, and you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. When Kim Stringer was a teenager, she was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Now, 27 years old, she sleeps in a shed and searches dumpsters for food. Her parents are facing a legal roadblock to getting her help. They want her to be involuntarily committed so that she can be treated for mental illness. But Stringer doesn't want that and isn't required to get it. WITF's Brett Schultes reports Stringer is at a crossroads.
There's a painting on the wall of Kim Stringer's home in Levittown. It depicts an open book next to a tree at the edge of a lake.
Whoever did it was really really talented, and I hope they went to school. I hope they went to college for some sort of like artwork.
Parked next to the painting in the dark, cluttered room is the shopping cart Kim pushes around the Bucks County community, scouring dumpsters like the one where she found this painting.
I found that in the trash, and I found that in the trash. And it was at my high school, local high school, Pennsbury High School.
There was a time when she herself might have thought about studying art. Her high school graduation photo lists graphic design as a college plan.
I feel like they're both well, and the lake in the background, and the trees.
But any such aspirations are long gone. Stringer was diagnosed with bipolar disorder in high school and was on lithium and Seroquel. But she stopped taking medication when she was 18 and hasn't seen a psychiatrist ever since. At this point in her life, she says she doesn't want or need treatment.
If a person responds in a certain way, they're going to be looked at as bipolar. But people aren't seeing like, hey, like if someone gets angry and punches a hole in the wall, is that person really bipolar? No, that person is going through a problem.
That hole she punched in the wall is visible in her apartment. Her parents bought the place for her so that she wouldn't be homeless, but she uses it for storage, preferring to stay in an aluminum shed in the backyard, like the kind you'd use to store a lawnmower and tools.
Pretty much I read, like I'll read a book, I'll read books. Sometimes I'll read the dictionary.
Kim says she's fine, but her parents fear for her health and her life. So let's rewind a couple of hours.
There goes my son, Sam, off for a piano lesson. Well, we'll go out to the pool this way.
Kim's mom, Martha Stringer, is walking around the family home in Yardley, about 3 miles from Levittown.
This is kind of our sanctuary back here.
Martha says she hoped the family pool would make her house the go-to spot for neighborhood kids and a safe place for her own children. But as Kim grew up, her disorder proved to be more than Martha ever imagined.
We can't seem to get her help because she doesn't want it.
Martha notes that in Pennsylvania, you have to be considered an immediate threat to yourself or others to be involuntarily committed.
She hovers just right below that.
Her husband, Paul, says Kim did once get admitted to the emergency room after saying she was suicidal.
She sat in a room, in the emergency room, for 9 hours. Finally, I see Kim walking out, and I said, "What's going on?" She goes, "Well, nobody came to see me, so I just want the F out of here."
The Stringers contacted the hospital CEO and a Bucks County commissioner, and as they describe it, they forced a meeting.
We got a brief flurry of activity. And then time passed. And then there was the next episode.
Paul says the next episode involved his daughter kicking in a window, badly cutting her leg in the process, and threatening to kill him.
And I looked at the police officers, and I said, "And that's not enough?"
In 2016, Kim ended up in jail after not paying a fine.
Contempt of court. That really was the beginning of a pretty steep decline. Her
legal problems aren't over either. Martha says Kim faces charges of receiving some stolen purses and is going before a judge in August. The Stringers fear another stay in jail will only make Kim worse. They're desperate to get her psychiatric treatment.
She's going to either hurt herself or someone else. That's kind of the cloud we're under.
Kim Stringer's situation reflects that of many adults who live with a serious mental illness in Pennsylvania. Organizations like the PA Mental Health Association and Mental Health Consumers Association oppose any changes to law that would make it easier for people to be involuntarily committed. There's also a new law, Act 106, that can make outpatient involuntary commitment easier, but counties are not required to implement it, and so far, no county has done so. This brings us just about back to where we started. Martha and Paul drive from Yardley to Levittown to bring their daughter some food and check in on her. Today, like so many days, Paul finds her sitting in the shed.
She doesn't want to be close to technology and the TV. And
Paul is surprised that Kim seems eager to talk to me about mental health. Kim says she's been discriminated against by the mental health system. She says she wants to show her perspective, but nothing about this is easy.
It's difficult because, like, you know, you're sitting there being discriminated for no reason. You're sitting there being told that the way that you're thinking or the way that a person is, the way the person thinks is wrong. And you're sitting there and
well, we don't want to do that.
Shut up, Mom. I don't want to hear your voice. I don't want to hear that. I don't, please stop. Please stop talking.
To Kim, the problem is that society has told her she has a problem.
To sit there and tell a little child that there's something wrong with the way that the child thinks. Because it just...
With this story about to air, Martha sends me an email around 10:30 p.m. She says she's just gotten back from the police station. Martha says Kim showed up at their house in the evening and began shouting and screaming. Police arrived and decided to file a 72-hour involuntary commitment. Now, Martha says she prays that at the end of that 3-day period, police will petition to get Kim a longer stay and get her the help that she says her daughter needs so desperately. In Levittown, Bucks County, I'm Brett Schultes.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, Folly Water and 7 other Frank Lloyd Wright buildings have been included on UNESCO's World Heritage List. We'll visit with Folly Water's director. Plus, it's been nearly 9 months since the Tree of Life Synagogue mass shooting. A conversation with former New York Times reporter Mark Oppenheimer, who's writing a book. He says the healing continues, but the sorrow remains. If you missed anything from today's program, or if you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovic, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.